Hello, this is Mark Steiner, and welcome back, everybody. This hour, we bring you a panel discussion we recorded at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, on race, the civil rights movement, in music and media. Kimberly Moffitt, who's been a guest on the show many times, assistant professor in the Department of American Studies at UMBC, was our moderator. And other UMBC faculty members joined the discussion. Derek Musgrove, who's assistant professor in the Department of History, Michelle Scott, associate professor in the Department of History, and Daphne Harrison, professor emerita in Africana Studies and founder of UMBC's Humanities Center.
Good evening and welcome. As your moderator for this evening, I thought I would start out at least evoking the spirit of what we plan to do during this panel discussion by just sharing a couple of titles with you. Lift Every Voice and Sing in 1900 by James Weldon Johnson. Times, They Are Changing, Bob Dylan, 1964. Change Gonna Come, Sam Cooke, 1964. Strange Fruit, 1939, by Billie Holiday, sung by Billie Holiday. And of course, We Shall Overcome, considered the formal anthem of the civil rights movement. All of these songs conjure up the passion and purposefulness of the civil rights movement. These freedom songs provided a stirring musical accompaniment to the campaign for racial justice and equality in the region during the late 1950s and early 60s. Whether sung at mass meetings, on marches and sit-ins, or en route to some of the forbidding jails, or whether performed on stage or record by one of the musical ensembles formed by civil rights activists, these songs convey the moral urgency of the freedom struggle, while also expressing and helping to sustain the courage of the extraordinary, ordinary people who were at the heart of it. Today's panel gives us the opportunity to hear issues that are associated with race, but in particular, focusing on the civil rights movement, its music, and the role of media. Our guest tonight will shed light on that conversation for us, but I should also mention to you that tonight's panel is being taped for broadcast by the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, an NPR member affiliate station at Morgan State University. And we hope at the end of our Q&A session, or during our Q&A session, that we can certainly entertain several questions from the audience, which will, of course, be broadcast on the show later. So our guests for this evening, we'll hear from them in the order that I mentioned them. Dr. Derek Musgrove is an assistant professor in the history department here at UMBC, will speak to us this evening on segregated popular music, integration of pop culture through rock and roll and soul music, and the incorporation of protest themes of the civil rights movement in the early 1960s. Dr. Michelle Scott, who is an associate professor of history at UMBC, will speak to us about changes in popular music during the Black Power era, 1966 to 1974. We will also hear from Mark Steiner, who is the founder of the Center for Emerging Media and the host of the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM. He will speak specifically about changes in the civil rights movement music, as well as the role of the media. And then finally, we'll hear from Dr. Daphne Harrison, emerita professor from Africana Studies and one of our founders of the UMBC Humanities Center. She will serve as the respondent to our panel prior to us opening up for questions and questions. At this time, if I could please have Dr. Musgrove join us at the podium.
Good evening, everyone. Maurice Berger's For All the World to See forces us to wrestle with the complex interplay between popular culture and political change. So in that spirit, I want to discuss the connection between rock and roll and the civil rights movement in the 1950s. And let me be clear, because most of my colleagues are going to talk about the connection between music and social change and how one actually fuels the other. What I'm going to talk about here is how rock and roll really stands aloof from the civil rights movement for most of the 1950s and only gets to be a part of it really in the early 1960s. So rock and roll and the civil rights movement develop in lockstep. Both the music and the movement had quiet beginnings in the post-World War II period. A slow but steady expansion among African Americans and a small number of whites in the early 1950s, and an explosion into the national consciousness in 1954. The symmetry was absolutely stunning. It's just 2 months apart, where you have Brown v. Board of Education in May 1954, and then in July 1954, Elvis comes out with his first commercial hit. And their development overlapped to such a degree that many Americans then and now supposed that they were directly linked. Segregationists in the South in the 1950s basically argued that the rock and roll was a NAACP conspiracy to force integration onto the population. And you actually have citizen council members going and beating up rock and rollers or protesting concerts in the late 1950s. Many rock and roll artists and producers actually claimed that they were significantly responsible for a lot of the changes brought about by the civil rights movement. I want to suggest two things that are a little bit at odds with those interpretations. First, the link between rock and roll and the civil rights movement is deserving of and has received serious academic study, but rock and roll coincided with the civil rights movement more than it influenced it. At best, rock and roll began the process of desegregating U.S. popular culture and generally creating a cultural climate that was receptive to desegregation. But rock and roll was not, I repeat, it was not activism. It was music, and at its worst, rock and roll could actually reflect the white supremacy that was quite prevalent in American society. Second thing I'm going to suggest, only in the early 1960s when protest became almost inescapable, and for lack of a better word, it actually became hip, did rock and roll musicians begin to pick up some of the themes that were coming out of the civil rights movement. But prior to that time, they really didn't talk about it at all. Now, this all sounds, I'm sure, very boring and academic, and for goodness sake, I've got on a bow tie, right? But what I'm going to do this evening is play some good music for all of you to jazz the whole thing up. So let's have some fun. Let's talk about the segregated popular culture of the 1950s to start off. In the 40s and 50s, American popular culture, like American society, was segregated. Billboard magazine had two charts, the pop charts, which were for white artists, and the R&B charts, which were black artists, and the R&B basically meant anything that black people did that wasn't jazz or gospel. Radio stations were segregated. If there were white stations that played black music, they'd play it during the black hour. And of course, record stores were segregated. If you wanted to get black music, you had to go to a black store. If you wanted white music, you went to a white store. But many young whites wanted to hear rhythm and blues. They found the prevalent pop sound boring. It was their parents' music. The R&B sound, on the other hand, was risque and sexy, and you could dance to it. In fact, many of the white youth of the 1950s saw the music as being more authentic. So some young whites, enthralled by the music, R&B that is, swelled the listening audiences of Negro-slanted radio shows or trooped across town to buy records from black music shops or even went and bought whites-only tickets to black clubs where they usually had to stand behind a rope and actually couldn't desegregate the dance floor and go and dance with black patrons so they wouldn't, you know, offend the local authorities. But they were willing to do this because the music was good. Now, record producers, realizing the tremendous desire for R&B among many young whites, began to work hard to find a crossover hit. Or as Sam Phillips, the producer who discovered Elvis, put it, a white man who had the Negro sound and the Negro feel. And so let's talk about the crossover in 1954, and that's rock and roll. Producers were able to find a few young white artists who had that Negro sound and Negro feel, as Phillips put it. And one of them was Bill Haley, lead singer for the Comets, who recorded the song that really became the anthem for a young generation that focused on rock and roll, and that's Rock Around the Clock. Here we go.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me home. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4, if the band's going
now. And of course, Elvis put out his first album in 1954 as well. These white crossover artists opened the way for many black artists who were already well-established in the R&B marketplace, but hadn't been able to cross over in a serious way to a white audience. And one of the people that was able to do that on the back end of Haley and the Comets and Elvis Presley was Little Richard, who in 1955 recorded Tutti Frutti. Now, for the next several years, a majority of the songs in the Billboard Top 10 were rock and roll songs, and a significant number were sung by blacks. The charts, in effect, after 1954, had been desegregated. Desegregation did not, however, eliminate racial inequality in popular culture, and this is perhaps best seen through the process of covering songs. For those of you who aren't familiar with the term, covering is simply recording a song that someone else has already recorded. It's not a bad thing in and of itself. Some of my favorite songs are covers of songs that other people have done. But what occurs in the late 1950s is a large number of white artists record or cover songs that black artists had done. And independent of the quality of the covers, they tend to sell better, largely because white disc jockeys would automatically discard the black recording and start playing the cover. And of course, the spins on by the white disc jockeys would allow these songs to go up the charts and to sell more. And one horrible example of this occurred in 1956 when Pat Boone, the white artist, recorded Tutti Frutti. His version, which you'll hear in just a moment, went to 12 on the Billboard charts. Little Richard's never went above 17. And here's Pat Boone's version of Tutti Frutti. Bop, bop, a loo, mop, a lop, bop, bop, Tutti Frutti, all Rudy. Tutti Frutti, all Rudy. Tutti Frutti, all Rudy. I got a gal, her name's Sue. She knows just what to do. I got a gal, her name's Sue. I think we can stop it there. So rock and roll desegregates the Billboard charts, but it doesn't do much to integrate the message of popular music. Rock and roll, after all, was big business, dictated by a white mass market. To focus too closely on black life or to forcefully articulate black aspirations risks losing white fans. As such, rock and roll focused almost exclusively on the issues of youthful rebellion and love and loss. Overt protest themes only entered popular music in the 1960s, when the pressure became too great, quite frankly, to ignore it. And even then, it often came from folk, jazz, blues, and soul artists, not rock and rollers. It took people of conscience willing to risk financial jeopardy to marshal the power of the music for the movement. And it took those people until the early 1960s to show up. But thank goodness that they did. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I want to thank you for having me. Derek's and our presentations kind of segue right off of each other. I'm going to be talking about a shift in the sound of soul, popular music, and the Black Power era. The change that was spoken of in Sam Cooke's words, "a change is going to come," definitely appeared both in movement politics and how the movement affected American popular music. In the aftermath of tangible progress like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but increasingly violent civil rights protests like Selma and increasingly dramatic urban unrest in Detroit, Newark, and Watts, the civil rights movement started to divide in terms of tactics. When some participants doubted the effectiveness of the strategy of nonviolence and multiracial coalitions, these members began to think that perhaps the efforts to change the, quote, hearts and minds of Americans might not produce the results of true political, economic, and social equality, and that separation, armed self-defense, and later a celebration of black cultural nationalism might be a better strategy in dealing with racial oppression in the United States. It was an era in which there were many decided attempts to confront the initial images that are placed in the beginning of the For All the World to See exhibit, the images of the Sambo, the Mammy, the white-only signs that plagued American life. But ironically, as the music became more political, message music, and expressed the message that black was beautiful, It also reflected political songs that shared a wider multiracial audience and also reflected a wider multiracial system of producers, record companies, and radio production. Now, Black Power, as a political term, was coined in 1966 by the new chairman of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Stokely Carmichael, and it was meant to reflect a collaboration or a description of a need for immediate political and economic power in Black communities by Black people. Black power politically transfers over into cultural nationalism when we talk about arts. And by cultural nationalism, I mean an expression of the acceptance that Black was beautiful in hairstyles, dress, a connection with an African heritage, food ways, speech, calling each other brother and sister, a deep connection in the face of the fact that Africanness or Blackness was trying to be degraded in mainstream society, accepting that and kind of coming together in a pan-African unity, which is seen in that same time period that's happening in 1966. Now, what does this have to do with music? In terms of how cultural nationalism is reflected in popular music, it's seen through the eyes of soul music. Soul music is very similar to the music styles that we've heard in terms of early R&B, in the sense that it was essentially produced by African Americans. But the messages, particularly in this period that I'm talking about between 1966 and 1973, were different in the sense that they focused more on the issues that were happening internally in African American communities, looking at the issues of poverty, segregation, the need for positive Black images. It differed slightly from 66 on in that Motown, which was R&B music, had really dominated the charts from 1959 to about 1966. And in terms of Motown, I'm talking about the Supremes, the Temptations. But the change happens when you start to enter record companies like Stax Records, based in Memphis. And the sound becomes a reflection of Southern soul, Southern blues, harder hitting rhythms, and particularly in this period of time, more political messages. So without further ado, let's get to the music, which is why you guys are here in the first place. The slide that you see here, which I was trying to show you for to describe cultural nationalism, was Nina Simone in that time period in 1966. But I want to start out with one of my favorites, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. And we're going to hear a bit of Respect, recorded in 1967. Respect, starting in being recorded in 1967, had been written by Stax artist Otis Redding and recorded earlier in 1965. Yet when Aretha Franklin sings it, the Queen of Soul, it's a plea for respect for African American communities, but can also be seen as a plea for or a demand for respect for female equality. At the same time that you see the emergence of the Black Power movement, you also see the rise of women's liberation happening at the same time. And I think Aretha Franklin kind of spans that gap. Now, music after the assassination of Martin Luther King in April of 1968 becomes even more overt in its messages in terms of asking or demanding Black power. And it would not be a talk of soul music if I didn't play the Godfather of Soul, Soul Brother Number One, James Brown.
Amen. Amen.
Say it loud.
Say it loud.
One more time. Say it loud.
Now, the irony of the fact that this is music from the Black Power era, but it also has a crossover appeal, is that in doing the research for this, I found a recording of James Brown performing at the Hugh Hefner Mansion in Chicago in 1968 in Playboy After Dark, in which the entire audience around him sitting in the salon in After Dark in the Playboy Mansion are all white people who are following the Playboy magazine. And as he says, "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud," everybody in the circle around him, and none of them are black, are there saying, "I'm black and I'm proud." So it's a crossover message politically that in which this music is becoming popular music with these very decided political themes. After 68, there is a merger or a shift that happens in black record companies like Motown. Motown had been long wary about actually being overtly political. Berry Gordy was very dedicated towards having a stylized music that was set for dancing, in which you had refined, perfectly coiffed, perfectly dressed, four tops, the Supremes, to the fact that even when his artists that had been signed in the late 60s, like the Jackson 5, were asked about what's your feelings about black power, the Motown rep would step in and say, "They have no feelings about black power, they're a commercial product." Well, this change happens in terms of you cannot keep political messages out with individual artists like Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, and the Temptations, who, fueled by the images of anti-war protests, rising poverty, police brutality, decide that it's not enough to sing about how they heard it through the grapevine any longer, and actually need to try to change their songs to reflect the world around them. Now, much like jazz became America's popular swing music of the 1930s and 40s, and the basic tenets of blues music served as a foundation for rock and roll, the shift in soul music in the late 1960s and early 70s became a fundamental part of American popular music, a fundamental part that can be heard in hip-hop, alternative music, and the rock sound of today. Thank you.
How's everybody doing? Good? So I didn't really bring a lot of music because I thought I was just talking today. And just quite controlled into singing, but I don't think we're going to do that either today. We might. But one of the things I was thinking about, the reason I wanted to do this today is that I think I was asked to do this today because I'm probably the oldest person on the panel, and I lived through the period we're talking about. And the period was my period. And what was described by both of our panelists so far was real. In Baltimore, Baltimore was the South. It was the Upper South, the Lower North, and the Upper South, all wrapped in one. This was a segregated city, and all that means. The Eastern Shore of Maryland was Mississippi. It still is Mississippi in some ways. Mississippi's moved far ahead of the Eastern Shore. I can attest to that now. I'm also asked to come up here because I was a civil rights worker when I was a kid. I walked my first picket line when I was 13 years old at the White Coffee Pot at the Mondawmin Shopping Center with a group called the Civic Interest Group, which was Baltimore's arm of SNCC. And when I was 11 years old, for all kinds of strange reasons, I won't go into the entire story now, I ended up integrating a Boy Scout troop at the Faith Baptist Church on Ashland Avenue in East Baltimore when I was 11. And that was in 1957, so you know how old I am now. And that period, it was a profound moment. And the music reflects that moment. In 57, two things happened to me and the Boy Scouts in that troop that kind of are emblematic of what that period was about. One was we were being driven home one day by our scoutmaster, Mr. Dennis Foster, and we stopped at a little shop. It was a donut shop or ice cream shop on the east side. And all the guys piled out of the car, and I sat in the back seat and didn't move. And Mr. Foster came over and said, "Come on, Mark, come on out and get whatever we're getting." I said, "No, I'll just stay here, And he said, "No, man, you understand. Wherever we can go, you can go." And when Edwin Johnson, who later became a Black Panther and a city councilman for a while, who was my partner in the Boy Scout troop and became an auto worker, I used to visit him on the east side at his house. I was the only white guy in the neighborhood running around Gay Street 1957, but he became the only black guy running around my street in Miami Place. And the receptions were very different. My reception was, I was part of the neighborhood. People hung out. We played hopscotch. We played basketball. We shared a bed, four to a bed, at his house. He came to my house. My neighbors didn't want to play with him. And to make their point, they tied me to a tree over at Red Ant Colony and left me there. That was the period we grew up in. So it was the music reflects the pain and power of that moment. And the civil rights movement was something, unless you were there, unless you were a certain age, people don't have a sense of what that meant. People did it because of something they believed. And that was the first half of our panel discussion on the civil rights movement in music and media that we recorded at UMBC. When we come back, more live discussion, audience participation, and more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back as we continue our panel discussion on the civil rights movement in music and media. We recorded at UMBC. We continue now with UMBC Professor Emerita Daphne Harrison sharing her story on how she fought against racism during the Jim Crow era.
During that period, I had little ones, two children, a son and a daughter, who were about 8 and 10, maybe younger than that, and a very dear friend who was a single mother too, and she had a daughter. So guess what we decided to do for the civil rights thing? We were living in Florida now, South Florida, Fort Lauderdale. All the beautiful beaches, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, we went to beaches now. But do you know they had the colored beaches? But me and another friend who was not married, but she was our buddy, and three children, decided we were going to desegregate Fort Lauderdale Beach. And so we put the children in the car with us and drove up to that main part where you could only park if you were going down on the beach. And it was very interesting because as soon as we parked, what do you think happened? A police car came up behind us, did not stop us, just rolled away a little bit and parked where he could see us. And here we go with an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 12-year-old between us. And the three little old teachers with the children. Children were excited because they loved going to the beach anyway, but we'd always gone down to the colored beach, which was on the end. But that day we decided we weren't going to be colored. And we got out, took our blankets and everything and laid them out. And of course, one of us watched the children as they went into the water, but the other two of us watched everything else to be sure we were safe. And it was very interesting because we decided we were going to stay only a small amount of time, but we weren't going to just do it in an ordinary way. We brought sandwiches to set out our little picnic, just like all of the other people did. And we stayed a sufficient amount of time to keep from being afraid that something awful was going to happen. And then we got in the car with the children and drove away. Now, Fort Lauderdale, during that period, was not nearly as racist as some of the other parts of Florida were. But it was an instance that we just decided they had to know that we weren't going to be colored anymore. And after a while, I would say in less than 3 or 4 months, all of that dissipated. And you could go anywhere you wanted to when you went to the beach in Fort Lauderdale. Now, that's just one example of how people just decide they're just going to be ornery and be themselves. Well, I'm an aunt. Well, there's a gentleman here who knows I'm ornery. But I'm the daughter of the first African-American to enroll at the University of Florida. And this woman already had a master's degree. But she decided she was going to test the waters. So she and her younger cousin, who is a cousin of mine also, who was a Morehouse College graduate, decided they were going to enroll at the University of Florida. Now, that sounds like, well, but I'm talking about the same era that we have been looking at over this period where this whole thing has come up. And it was very, very invigorating, but it also meant that other people began to see that you don't have to do anything grand to change the world that you live in. You have to have resolve. You have to believe it is right. As they say in some services, it's meet and right so to do. And you have to believe that no matter what happens, you are strong enough, you are brave enough, and you are proud enough to stand up for what this country says it is. Now, that is something that should be an ongoing pledge of each of us sitting in this room. But because we've got so much from that era that we're talking about now, we don't realize we're now in another era that is beginning to be very, very, very touchy. Things are not as solid as they seem. So I believe that this panel and Michelle and those who pulled this together have done us a great service, because we need to think about how we here sitting together all mixed up sizes, colors, and shapes with all kinds of different aspirations, memories, and hopefulness, that we have to continue that fight that began back in that period. Thank you.
Someone else.
Thank you. As I was listening to Mr. Steiner talk and then Dr. Harrison, I was thinking that the radicalism, for lack of a better word off the top of my head, of the meaning of the music doesn't necessarily always come from the song itself. It comes from the use of the song. Mm-hmm. And so, and it just was an interesting contrast to the first two speakers and the last two speakers talking about kind of the origins of the music on the one hand and then the use of the music on the other hand. So I didn't know if we knew anything more about the uses that some of those non-political songs might have been put to, or maybe building on that, do you think there's any, even in the case of music that wasn't overtly political, is it political that people got together to listen to them?
The reality is that most of the music that was in the freedom movement was church music, was gospel music. And gospel music had its own part of gospel music, in the black world especially, uniquely, had its roots in resistance. I mean, it was being able to sing your way to resist being in slavery. You could sing it in a way that said something hidden and alive for people at the same time. I mean, that's part of the root of it. I mean, so these songs aren't new. I mean, the We Shall Overcome is not a gospel song. We Shall Overcome was a 1930s song for the workers' movement that was adopted by the civil rights movement. But the other songs came out of the church, and that was resistance. So the root was resistance, and it was used for resistance. And there was some resistance to that resistance. By that I mean, in the church, like I remember very distinctly, there were three or four churches in Baltimore that stood behind the civil rights movement. Sharp Street Methodist Church, Union Baptist, Douglas Memorial. Most churches didn't. They were afraid to stay, be part of the civil rights movement. And they people object to using the music. You're using these songs for protest. You know, you are secularizing our songs. But there was no stopping it. So, I mean, so it was very complex.
If I can just add, I mean, Denise, I think you make an excellent point. I left this out just because I wanted to make sure I was in the time frame. But 1955, the number one pop chart hit is The Great Pretender by The Platters. And, you know, you can make a pretty strong case, I think, that when white Americans and black Americans heard that song, they thought of it differently, right? I mean,
yeah.
Most historians argue that when, you know, white youth heard The Great Pretender, it was about, you know, a boy who is pretending to be all right, even though he sees a girl who has spurned him, right? So it's a love story, and, you know, I'm pretending that I'm okay. And they would also argue that for many African Americans, it was sort of a we wear the mask type of interpretation, which is that, you know, I'm smiling because I'm sort of on the bottom now, but, you know, I'm really angry. It's just that I'm powerless, and so I have to act this way in front of you. It could go either way. I think that the context is terribly important. Even when you look at Sam Cooke's Change Gonna Come, mm-hmm. It's possible, it's hard, but it's possible to, you know, if that song comes out in 74 or, you know, 1933 as opposed to 1963, that you could see that differently, that it's not a civil rights song, that it's just, you know, a song about a poor kid who's trying to make it in the world. But because it came out in 1963, it became a movement anthem, and he intended it to be. But you could interpret it differently. So absolutely, I think that the interpretation is critical.
I can't get away from the image that Michelle offered us of the call and response between James Brown and his white audience in the Playboy Mansion. I'm sure all of the panelists could comment on this, but if Dr. Scott could start by talking a little bit about the intersectionalities between gender and race in the Black Power musical culture.
Okay. I think you can really kind of see the connections between the Women's Liberation Movement and Black Power, starting with that respect song. So the fact that it's being written as a ballad, a love ballad, as many of the popular culture music was, by Otis Redding, it was sung about a demanding respect in an unrequited love relationship. Now, when Aretha Franklin records it 2 years later in 1967, she's still singing, at least publicly, about this love relationship. But the very fact that she is singing it and kind of making it her own and her anthem, and she adds her ad-libs about asking about our, you know, respect, spelling it out, and talking about taking care of business at the end of it, could be about a romantic relationship. But she was also on the scene demanding respect as a black woman, which perfectly entwines that intersectionality. The very fact that you have, even as the women's liberation movement is starting, that it's not necessarily seeing women being equated with black women. Women's equated with white, and blackness is equated with being male. So you see these things that are not necessarily decidedly political when they come out, but then all of a sudden that popular mainstream America is embracing, whether they know it or not, these very overtly critical messages that she's demanding respect from not just, you know, mainstream society, but from males within the African American community as well. So that's a good one to kind of talk about that intersection.
I think also we have to remember that message in music, in a rather unusual way, is a part of the African American musical culture. It has had to be that way from the time that the first slaves hit these shores. And because they learned how to use the music of their captors, and they learned how to have to be Christians, whether they even knew anything about such a thing, they took that and rearranged it, both historically and as well as meaningfully, so that they could sing what we would say church songs in non-church environments and with different kinds of rhythms and get the information out very clearly. And that's not something that just happened in the last 100 years. That's something that happened when they first arrived and realized that they were going to have to find a way to communicate in a land that they don't know of, in languages and customs that they don't know and understand, and in terms of what they saw as their religions that were in direct conflict with how they saw the other world.
If I could ask very quickly of the panel, I was curious of thinking about what is in other forms of media the same time the music is going on. I'm thinking about television shows from the 50s, television shows from the 60s and 70s. Were they in line with the music and what we were experiencing, or were they counter to?
And so, but it didn't, let me just say that it didn't reflect. Hollywood's interpretation of the 60s was the Mod Squad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a white woman, a black guy, and a white guy who were former radical underground people, dope-smoking hippies, who they got to be undercover cops. So that was their... So it really didn't. I mean, it reflected... To me, the TV of the 60s and 50s reflected the resistance to change. And I don't think the media really reflected the change until much later.
I'm also thinking about movies... Melvin Van Peebles' Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song of 1971, thinking about any of the Shaft films, just wondering if it is in line with much of the music during the same period.
Yeah. Well, I think particularly the movies that you just mentioned are being scored by these soul musicians. So Shaft is being, you know, the score is written by Isaac Hayes. If you're looking at Curtis Mayfield, who was scoring Claudine in 1974, there is a decided push to kind of push the music with the themes of the mm-hmm. movies. Even though these movies, blaxploitation films, are supposed to mimic the heroic figure in black culture, and many of them were not produced or written by African Americans themselves, you still see this venue or this opportunity to have soul musicians become music composers. So James Brown is writing, or not fully writing, but dictating to his music director, music for Black Caesar, for example. So you kind of see that emergence of a new venue. But I don't think without those particular blaxploitation films, you would have that same correspondence with the music and the Hollywood film.
One more question.
Do you have a sense of the artist level of involvement in the movement?
The artists?
Right, their level of involvement in the movement.
Well, I'll just start off again real fast. They were deeply involved, a lot of artists.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people like Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte and others were there. I mean, there's a story that Harry Belafonte tells that he forced Sidney Poitier to do this with him. When SNCC needed money, they went through this torturous thing to get $50,000 in cash to take down the SNCC, to get people out of jail. And to have money to back up. So people were there. People like Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, and singers like that were down south and sang at different rallies all the time throughout the South, at least in the Mississippi. So artists were involved. I mean, and a lot of artists came out of the movement as well. Before he went, and then again, there's like the March on Washington in 63, it was very safe an establishment in many ways to do. But a lot of artists came out for that, right from Charlton Heston to Marlon Brando. I mean, they were all there. So they were there. But what was most important was the 60s gave birth to an artistic movement that kind of burst onto the scene is kind of, I think, reflects a lot of work that goes on today. But so else want to grab more of that?
Well, you go ahead.
Well, I would just jump in to talk really quickly about the period that precedes the one that Mark refers to, which is that, you know, the early 50s, a lot of artists stay aloof from the movement. They saw what happened to Paul Robeson, although that has more to do with the Cold War, I think, than the burgeoning civil rights movement. He was blacklisted. His revenue per year went from, I think, $100,000 a year to, like, less than five. And so people stayed aloof. I mean, Nat King Cole actually says in the early 50s, I'm not going to get involved in civil rights. I don't want to talk about it. you know, and of course the circuit in the South that is many of these artists' bread and butter is segregated. You know, so you just don't have the room. And Nat King Cole, to use the example, changes his tune for two reasons. One is that Asa Carter, a very, very famous Alabama white supremacist, who was one of those interesting people who was both a member of the Klan and the Citizens Council, and ended up being a speechwriter for George Wallace when he was governor of Alabama, orchestrated a attack on him when he went to go perform in Birmingham. And a bunch of white men actually jumped up out of the audience and pummeled him on stage while he was performing. And after that, he said, look, I don't want to have anything to do with it. I'm not going to talk about civil rights. And then the NAACP essentially went after him and said, you know, we've been supporting you. Black folks support you. You need to support us in the movement. And they put so much pressure on him that he started constantly contributing, became a lifetime member very publicly. And from that point onward, was relatively outspoken, although most of it was financial. And so, you know, you can see this, you know, this moment in the 50s, up through the mid-50s, the late 50s, where, you know, artists really do have a choice. And when they look at it, it doesn't necessarily make good financial sense to stick their neck out and say something positive about the movement. But usually there are moments along the way where a select number of people are nudged toward that position. But it's not a natural one, is the point I want to make.
What's also interesting, can you hear me? Also interesting is there were people like Muddy Waters and Ma Rainey who were really on the, you know, their popularity was on the deep decline. But when this period starts, some people begin to perform again. And it's interesting because they performed again in the South, but Chicago became the city where the blues singers and the jazz artists began to go there. Those that went to New York had almost a different kind of reason, because New York has a whole different look at what real down and dirty blues and that kind of thing is. But Chicago opened up. And so you began to see that this move back and forth from Chicago down to New Orleans, to Chicago to Mississippi, and old singers are still singing live, performing live during that time, because there's this interest from younger people to find out something about what the blues is really about. And when they're talking about jazz, they're not talking about Dizzy Gillespie. They're talking about jazz from the earlier era. And that's the kind that they can respond to. And you can dance in a small place like this, about this half size, and about one bar and about 15 people in there, just enough room for some of us to do the down and dirty, okay? So this is it's very involved, this whole business of African-American life and culture in this country. Because that same kind of thing has just rolled and rolled and rolled, and as new ways came in to be able to express ourselves, and new ideas and new technology, boy, they snapped into it, and that's why we see so much variation in what is African American popular music now.
And that's all we have time for today. I hope you really enjoyed this rich cultural program and music of our civil rights movement and what it meant to change our society. Again, our panel was moderated by Kimberly Moffitt, assistant professor in the Department of American Studies, Derek Musgrove, assistant professor in the Department of History, Michelle Scott, associate professor in the Department of History, and Daphne Harrison, professor emerita in Africana Studies at UMBC and founder of UMBC Humanities Center. Thank everybody at UMBC and all the professors at UMBC for participating in this panel. It was a treasure and an honor to do so. I hope you all enjoyed it. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.